Welcome to PhD Careers in Life Sciences podcast, brought to you by the Office of Postdoctoral Affairs at NUS Medicine.
Hello everyone, my name is Hatati Tasena, a postdoctoral research fellow at the Yong Lu Lin School of Medicine, National University of Singapore. We created this podcast because we know that many current and aspiring PhD holders are curious about what lies beyond the traditional academic career path. In each episode, we will be joined by special guests who will share their post-PhD journey with us, how they have navigated their careers and found success in the path that you may not have considered before. You will hear real-life stories and practical insights to help you explore your own possibilities. New episodes drop every 2 weeks, so be sure to follow us and stay inspired. This podcast series is exclusively sponsored by Gene Wiss from Acenta Life Sciences. GeneWiz provides Sanger sequencing, next-generation sequencing, gene synthesis, gene-to-discovery solutions, including antibody production, viral packaging, and mRNA synthesis, and many more. So check out its website, genewiz.com, when you are looking for a reliable partner for your research. Follow the new LinkedIn GeneWiz from Acenta in bracket APAC for the latest updates on the go. A PhD student or postdoc thinking about making a career transition but not sure where to begin. Maybe you're still figuring out what direction you want to go in, which makes it even more difficult to know how to prepare. In this very first episode, I'm joined by Dr. Eve Zhao Wang, who is here to share practical ways any PhD student or postdoc can set themselves up for a smooth transition regardless of the path they take. After finishing her PhD, Eve jumped straight into a role as an analytic consultant in the pharmaceutical industry. Today, she is the Senior Business Development Manager at Omico, a not-for-profit organization bringing together Australia's top cancer institutes, researchers, clinicians, industry partners, and government to speed up cancer treatment. Beyond her passion for science, Eve has always been dedicated to developing herself and empowering others. And this made her the perfect guest to kick off this podcast series with us. Eve, it's a great pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Hatete. It's a great pleasure to be here with you today.
Thank you. So we have known each other for a few years now, but let's help our listeners get to know you a little bit better, all right? Mm-hmm. So first question, how would you describe yourself in one sentence?
Wow, only one sentence. That makes it difficult. That's just a joke. I think if I use one sentence to describe myself, I would say I'm a positive, probably joyful, lifelong learner. That's how normally my friends and colleagues describe me.
That's really cool. Okay, I did not expect that. It's so short, but it really represents who you are.
Thank you.
Well, for the past 8 years, right, you have been working in the pharmaceutical industry. Can you tell us what you do in your current role as Senior Business Development Manager at Omico and how your PhD has helped you in your job so far?
Yep. So I will answer the first question, what do I do here at Omico as a Senior Business Development Manager? So as you mentioned, Omico is a not-for-profit organization here in Australia. Yeah. At the moment, we have the largest cancer genomics program in Australia. We're all very proud to work on this project because it's quite unique even all over the world. And for me, my role is really to put it in a simple way, is to bridge the gap between the research and industry, or actually to bring them together. So at Omico, we are providing free NGS or comprehensive genomic profiling for patients with advanced cancer. And my role is to find those pharmaceutical companies or biotechs that have clinical trials that could benefit these patients and match these patients to these clinical trials. That's so basically what I'm doing.
Wow, I I think we all have come across someone who has cancer in our life, and some cases are more challenging than others. And I have always been wondering, how do people find like the latest hope that can help them, or at least like take the chance to try the latest treatment that maybe it's not commonly available yet.
Indeed, that's why I think everybody in Omico are very passionate about the work we do, because as you said, we are providing not only new options, but really it's that hope that if you have tried all the medicines that are currently available, what is the next option for these patients? So that's what we are doing.
Yeah, thank you. So how has your PhD helped you so far?
I think in two aspects how my PhD has helped me in my job. First of all, of course, it's the domain knowledge, because I did my PhD in breast cancer research, actually at Cancer Institute in Singapore, CSI. And the domain knowledge, of course, is very helpful when I talk to industry partners, so we can still have that scientific conversation. And at the same time, I think what a PhD offers us is not only the knowledge, but also the soft skills, for example, presentation and communication skills, and also mindset, like resilience. I remember going to these doing Western blot, probably a lot of PhD students do that. And every time I go there, oh my God, it's a negative result again, not what I expected. And then you just keep trying and trying. And as it develops a lot of resilience, and that's also what is required in, I would say, in every job. So yeah, to summarize, I think it's the scientific knowledge and also the soft skills.
You mentioned negative results lead to resilience. Wow. Yeah, I think that's important. So we don't need to be so sad when we face negative results. It's part of the things that build us who we are.
Yes, yeah,
Yeah.
indeed.
Thank
It's
you.
part of the
Okay.
process.
Right. Yeah. But actually, you actually went straight to industry right after your PhD. Have you
Yes.
ever considered doing postdoc?
Yes, I actually did. So I forgot whether it was in my second or third year of my PhD, I started thinking what I would like to do after my PhD. So I talked to a lot of people, including the Career Center at NUS, I remember, and also a lot of friends who have already been in the industry or friends who have started their postdoc. Initially, I thought I would do a postdoc before I moved to industry, because I said, oh, might be a good experience to have postdoc experience. But I remember the last piece of advice that I got from someone I know who by then he was already in the industry. He said, Eve, if you want to transition into industry, just do that now.
Oh, why
And
wait, right?
pardon?
Why wait?
Yeah, why wait?
Is that what he
Because
said? Okay, yeah.
yeah, basically what he was, I thought the industry would appreciate a postdoc experience. But my friend said, actually, unfortunately, your postdoc experience won't really add that much value because it's research experience. Then you don't really know much about the industry. If you want to transition, just make the jump now. I said, oh, really? That sounds a bit scary, but okay, let's do this. And by then, I was also moving to Australia because of my husband's job. We moved to Australia right after my PhD. So it was a challenging process because it's not only a new area, it's not research anymore. It was a new country,
Yeah.
right? Because everything was different. But yeah, to come back to your question, I did consider doing a postdoc, but in the end, I didn't.
Yeah, just for the benefits of our listeners, Eve graduated from National University of Singapore for her PhD. Yeah. So then, you have always been in Singapore and then you moved to Australia, yeah, for the
Indeed.
first job post PhD.
Yes.
You actually answered my question, my next question as well, because I wanted to ask what prompted your decision to join the pharmaceutical industry. I think you answered half of it.
And I think there specifically, on why, it's because I am someone who loves to make a difference or have an impact in the world. And that's also the reason why I started research. But after doing years of research, I realized that actually I would love to see the impact of my work more directly and more immediately. And research was unfortunately not satisfying enough for me personally. I know a lot of researchers love their work and do a great job, and they should totally continue doing that. But for me, doing basic research or translational research and not knowing the research will actually in the end lead to the ben to benefiting patients, that was just not satisfying enough. But in the pharmaceutical industry, things move much faster. For example, in my first job at Prospection, which is a data analytics company, but we were looking at patient data. So helping a drug to get listed on PBS, which is the pharmaceutical benefits scheme here in Australia, just getting that drug listed on PBS and knowing that patients now can access this drug without paying ridiculous amount of money. That was just like, oh my God, this is such a good feeling. I was part of that contribution. Yes. So that's why I decided to transition into the industry.
Very cool. I think many of us can resonate with that immediate that instant satisfaction. I wouldn't say that instant is not an accurate word because it still takes some journey to reach there, but at least you are able to see it within a reasonable timeline.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, but first job, prospection, you mentioned. How did you make that transition? It was scary, like you said.
Yeah, actually, it was not only scary, it was actually really how do you put this? Okay, I moved to Australia from Singapore with a PhD in in medicine or cancer research, and NUS is one of the top universities around the world, right? So, oh my God, everybody would want to hire me. But then coming here, it took me a while. Like I was looking for jobs and people sometimes were not getting back to me, or I didn't even get an interview, or I did interview but I didn't get the job. And actually it had a lot of impact on my self-confidence. I was walking around thinking, oh my God, I have no value and no worth in this world without a job. And that is just to share how sometimes we associate our identity and also our self-worth with the work we do. And back to your question, how did I make that transition? It was so I was doing a lot of networking events. I was going to attend a lot of events. And I also reached out to someone I met at the Hope Conference in Japan with Nobel laureates. So I represented US to go to Japan some years ago, and I met somebody there, and I know that he moved to Australia. So I said, let's have a chat. So what are you doing here in Australia? Maybe something relevant. And then I said, oh, I just moved to Australia and I am looking for a job, and his name is Prab. And he said, Eve, I have lots of patient data to analyze. Why don't you join us to do data analytics? I said, data analytics, I have no experience. Yeah, I have analyzed my Western blood data, my PCR data. That's it. He said, Eve, but if you got a PhD, you can do anything. I said, really? I said, I can try. And then I applied for the job and I got the job, and I was interviewed by the CEO by them because it was a small company. And yeah, I got my first job. I was so excited. So I stayed in the company for 5 years, learned a lot. I had three roles there. That was just absolutely a great experience.
Was that a training that you that helped you get started in your job, or was it mostly self-learned?
Like the skills, I think, It's
No,
not
no, no, no.
mainly self-learning. I think the team was very, very helpful. A lot of small things. For example, I mean, I already learned that, for example, presentation skills. When you prepare your slide deck, everything needs to be professional. But I remember small things like Prop taught me when you deliver your projects to your clients, if let's say it's a spreadsheet, it's an Excel sheet, you need to make sure that when you close your spreadsheet, it should be on the first page of your spreadsheet. So when the clients open it, it's also landing on the first page. It gives them a great experience. These are just small things, but also very helpful for my later career development to look professional.
We usually overlook this kind of small detail, but I
Indeed.
think especially from a perspective of maybe the person who created the document or the file. But as a user, sometimes when I open the Excel sheets that I'm not familiar with, multiple admin forms, I opened and found a page that I had no idea what this page was talking
Yeah,
about.
imagine you open the spreadsheet and it's in the middle of the file. People will be like, what is this about? It's just small things like that.
Okay, nice, thank you. Communications you mentioned seems like finding. Okay, let me try to summarize maybe your stories into a few components, a few factors that contributed to your success in transitioning out of academia, which I think are quite relevant to many of us. So from what I heard, there is mentorship because you actually reach out to people and found advice. There is networking. You mentioned already, yeah, there is soft skills or transferable skills, especially communication. There is also a period where you lost self-confidence, right? So somehow you need to bring it up to build that confidence to move on. Was there also something like, do you also felt like it was like in a high stress? Do we need to care for yourself? Do you also need to like go through some kind of internal struggles,
Oh, absolutely.
questioning? Yeah, it
Yes,
seems like there
yes.
was a period of a self-doubt.
Yeah.
Maybe let's go through this one by one because I think I would really love to learn how you did or overcome all these obstacles or achieve those aspects that help you with your transition.
Yep,
Maybe
sure.
let's talk about the first part first. I think many people know that they needed transferable skills. Because we all have research skills, of course. And I think soft skills are something that each PhD student or each postdoc is trained at a different scale. It also depends on our interest, right? How much we want to train ourselves. Even going to conference, I have seen PhD students who go to conference every year or multiple times a year. And I have also seen PhD students who only go like once in 4 years throughout their PhD. So it's really different. From my impression, I think one of your many strengths is communication. If you are such an effective communicator, in my opinion, we
Thank
have talked a few
you.
times already. When you share your ideas, you share it in such a clear and thoughtful way, and it comes across as both wise and genuine. So that
Thank
not
you.
only makes it easy for people to understand what you mean, but also make them trust you. I felt so like what's your secret, Eve? How did you like achieve this level of proficient in communication skill? Did it come from going to workshop, like trainings, hearing a lot of feedback, or something else entirely?
Yes, first of all, thank you for sharing that. I think that's quite an accurate description of my communication style. And in terms of how I develop this, I think actually it boils down to my love for people. And yes, I have attended workshops, and those are all techniques and skills, which is also important. Like when you communicate, you have to think about the people that you're talking to. But I feel I really care about the people that I'm talking to, and I'm very glad that the other person can actually feel that. In terms of communication, I am actually I am a lover of I love making things simple. I do remember when I was still doing my PhD in Singapore, I participated in this 3-minute thesis competition. So the idea is to share your PhD thesis or your PhD project in 3 minutes with
It's really empty.
audience. Yeah, with audience that are not experts in your field. And I forgot whether I got first prize or whatever prize. I in the end represented NUS to go to come to Australia. Now I'm in Australia. That was the first time in Brisbane attending the conference. So I think basically my message is that yeah, to make it simple and also really to think what is the listener, what is the audience interest, and what is important for them.
And is continuous development, right?
Yes.
So
Yeah,
you do
and I
not
think
change
that
anything.
skill is in professional life, also in personal life, with our family, with our friends, it's the same. That skill we can bring everywhere in our life.
So, apart from communication, what would be the next most important transferable skill in your opinion?
Second most important, I think it's actually adaptability or flexibility, being flexible, and also being open-minded, basically similar lines. For example, when I was at Prospection, I started as an analyst, at quite technical work. But after a few years, I felt I have reached the bottleneck of my career development as a data analyst. Because I was not interested in becoming deeply technical. And being adaptable and open-minded gave me the option to look at account management or business development, which is a commercial side of the organization. So then it's about preparing contracts, doing contract negotiation, going out to talk to clients, which really suited my strength as well. And till now, I'm still doing business development, combining that scientific knowledge with my strength of, communication, relationship building, and negotiation. So yeah, that's probably what I would say the second most important.
I think moving on from transferable skill, and we touched on the topic that I think is very challenging for many people, imposter syndrome. This keyword came up so many times in the conversation I had with my peers, PhD students or postdocs. And I think we scientists somehow, especially the junior ones, always feel like we, even in science, many times we feel like we're not. Maybe I'm not good enough, or that professors, they are so great, and I don't know if I will ever reach that level, or industry. Then it's worse thinking about transitioning out. It's like I know nothing about industry. How can I make it? I think you yourself have experienced some self-doubt as well, especially after multiple failure to secure a job, right? Tell us how you managed to overcome that and build your self-confidence over time or bring back your confidence.
Yeah, I think this self-doubt, in a way, sometimes a little bit self-doubt can be healthy, but indulging in self-doubt, of course, can bring us down. And for me, I can still vividly remember the self-doubt when I first moved to Australia. And I think as I progressed in my career, also just in general in life, as we get older, we get more wise. I did read a book called, I forgot the name, actually by Michelle Obama. I think it's The Light We Carry. So in her book, the first chapter was about self-doubt. And I was like, oh, so actually, really, famous or successful celebrities, they also have self-doubt. So this is not only me. So understanding that self-doubt is universal, is relieving, knowing that, oh, I'm not the only failure or the one who feels that I am not enough. And also, if we practice meditation or mindfulness, self-doubt is also just a feeling. The self-doubt doesn't exist in the physical world. It's a feeling, a thought that we have in our head. To realize that, to distinguish that, I think it's also very important. And also, I think as I move, advance my career, I do build more confidence. It's just, you know, with each job, even when we first started doing an experiment, we didn't know how to do these experiments in the first time or the second time or even the third time. But as you continue doing the same thing, you know you can be good at it. And the last thing I want to touch on is, for me, it's to also sometimes take a moment to look back on the journey we have traveled. For myself, I come from a small village in China. So I am a granddaughter of a farmer. And so coming from that kind of humble background, to being like to going to Singapore and now working in Australia, I know I have traveled very far, and I know I have built this life myself and also with the help with others. So that gives me tremendous amount of confidence of what I can achieve in life if I want to. So I would encourage everybody also to take a moment to look back how much we have traveled. If you already have a PhD or doing a PhD, come on, how many people can achieve that itself? So I think that's very important in overcoming self-doubt as well.
Thank you. So powerful. If I think how we have looked back to see how far we have come, and when you mention your personal background as well, this really explains why you value empowering others so much, because you really you have reached here yourself, and you would like to see others reach here too.
Oh, absolutely. I think for me, that's the most satisfying thing to do at the moment, because I am so happy with my own life now. And the next step, it is very natural. It's naturally to empower others to achieve the same.
Thank you. And yes, thank you for doing that through our podcast as well.
I'm very glad that you have given me this opportunity.
So I think at some point about your PhD journey, you were actually quite well aware of what kind of things that motivate you, the impact that you want to make, and how, like, how you think that, okay, at some point you will want to move out of industry, whether to do a postdoc or not. It's not, at that time, it was just a question. But in the end, you kind of know the direction you want to go into in the long run. But a lot of us, I think, are not aware yet where exactly they want to be in the end. They may still be doing PhD. They may be doing research in academia, postdoc or not. But they actually don't know what's next in the coming years. So I don't know how can we help, what advice do you have for people to slowly develop their self-awareness of what they truly want, or what truly suit them, especially in their professional environment?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think for most of us, it is the same. Like for me, also initially I thought I want to become an MSL, a medical science liaison. So when I first moved to Australia, I was really looking for an MSL job, because I talked to people. So I would also encourage people to talk to people with different let's say career trajectories. People in academia study postdoc and become assistant professor, or people who have been in the pharmaceutical industry, let's say, even in the pharmaceutical industry, there are so many roles, right? You can become a scientist, you can go into regulatory affairs or medical affairs, market access or health economics, different things. Or you can go into the consulting world. You can join a big consulting firm like McKinsey or more specialized consulting firm like LEK, those kind of things. So I would recommend going to events or just reaching out to people on LinkedIn or just through your own personal connections. Because once you know different options, you will be better be able to better assess what suits you. I know some people are not as extroverted as myself. So I would say, yeah, even just reaching out to people via emails, because then you don't have to meet people like in person. I have people who have reached out to me just via email. I answer their questions. When I met them in person, they were quite introverted, but that's totally fine. Not everybody is an extrovert. So just do whatever that suits you and find the option that works for you the best. So yeah, be open-minded and reach out to people. There are a lot of kind and helpful people out there who want to give back, like myself.
All right, if we never try, we will never meet them. So
yeah, exactly.
And also don't make our introversion. I felt that I'm an introvert, but I'm slowly learning how to be functional extrovert. So thanks for mentioning that being introvert shouldn't be an obstacle.
Yes. You have a lot of friends who are introverts as well.
And also, I think you highlight the approach that aligns with our thought as well. And that's why we launched this podcast, because we want to expose our current or aspiring PhD holders to as many career paths as possible, so that our next episodes, we will have guests from different career paths, industry, non-profit, or different kind of industries, or the non-traditional one, to join us as well in this podcast.
Yeah, that's great.
But we wanted to start with you because I know that you have a lot that is not only applicable to your own career path, but is applicable to any path that people want to take.
Oh, that's absolutely my pleasure to start the first episode.
So I think you mentioned reaching out to people, and I know that in our private conversation, we talk about mentorship all the times. I think it's something that all of us know that it's very important that we have a good mentor. But most of us don't really know how to find one. If you have been a great mentor to me throughout the past years. But you are also very good at finding mentors for yourself. So can you tell us your tips, how you do it, how you find your mentors?
Yeah. I mean, I actually have multiple mentors in my life for different areas of my life, I'd say. I think a simple way to find a mentor is just people around you. Let's say at your work, you can actually ask your professor to be your mentor. And I also think a mentor is not only for it also doesn't have to be just for professional development. It could also be personal development, right? So you can ask the people that you look up to in your immediate environment. And what I want to mention, what is very important, is you have to own the mentor and mentee relationship, because it's hard to expect your mentor to reach out to you and say, "Hi, Eve, should we have a meeting now?" No, you need to own that. Say, "Hey, so one of my mentors' name is Sarah. I said, Sarah, I would love to catch up with you, and this is what I would like to discuss. And when are you free?" Right. So that's one key point. And another mentor that I have since I moved to Australia, his name is Matt Britland. I actually reached out to him just because I was interested in becoming an MSO initially, and he was running the Medical Affairs Association here in Australia. And I met him. He's just one of the best human beings I have known. He was just like, "Eve, you have so much talent." And I was like, where is my talent? I had so much self-doubt by then. I
Mm-hmm.
was like, I don't even have a job yet. And he said, you are absolutely a rock star. I was like, I can't even see my own light, and let alone I'm like a rock star. And but really, like, mentors really lift you up. They see light in you that you can't see yourself. And they believe in you more than you believe in yourself. And they really empower you and lift you up. And Matt is still a very, very close friend of mine till today. Like, in fact, I'm also a family friend of his now. Like, I play with his child and all of that. So yeah, you can really take the mentorship very far if you would like to.
For Matt, especially, you reach out to him without even having him in your circle of
No, yeah.
friends, right? So it's like a cold call, send a message or email.
Yes.
Yeah.
I went to the event they organized. I messaged him on LinkedIn and I went to an event organized by him. Yeah, in the event, I was very proactive and also initiated a one-on-one conversation with him after that. So I was very proactive in finding a mentor because I have to own it. And mentors love giving back, but as a mentee, we have to tell them what we want.
I think that's so important. Like many of us have that fear, which make us don't dare to take the first step. But if we don't take that step ourselves, no one else will take that step for us. No one will come and then say, "Hey, Eve, do you want to be my mentee?"
Exactly. Do you need some mentorship? Do you need some? No, nobody probably would do that.
I don't know if you have experienced any kind of rejections or someone just ignore your message. I think that's also another type of fear.
Oh, absolutely. That's a very good question. Like, first of all, even just in terms of mentorship, right? You reach out to people on LinkedIn or at events. Sometimes people are not that enthusiastic or friendly, or on LinkedIn people just don't reply. That happens all the time. I mean, the fact that I have found Matt probably is one in a, I don't want to say one in a million, probably one in a decade, not dozens or like hundreds, right? But that's like for a lot of things. Even you go out dating in the beginning before when we were younger, you still can get rejection. But I think one thing I really learned about rejection or from the mentorship or even my job doing business development, I'm constantly reaching out to people, is don't take it personally. It's not about you. A lot of times it's just the other person is busy with their own life, or they have other priorities, and they might be dealing with really difficult things in your own life, and they just don't have the bandwidth to reach to reply to you. And then we start thinking, oh my God, it's because I'm not good enough. It has nothing to do with you. We are not the center of the universe. It's often what is happening in their own world. So that's the most important message I want to share. It took me years to learn that, but now I think I'm doing much better. And I also don't get disheartened when people don't reach reply. If you really are keen to talk to that person, just follow up.
Thank you for that important reminder. It's not about you. It's not about
yes.
us. So it's just for the benefit of our audience, I just want to mention that the NUS Medicine Office of Postdoctoral Affairs also offer mentorship program. So if you if any audience feel like you need some stepping stone, you need some help to reach out to have a mentor for yourself. So our program offer both academia and commercial mentor. So I think apart from, I would still encourage everyone, just like Eve say, to try to find mentor in your circle or even cold call, send message to people. But you can also consider joining our program. Can follow our LinkedIn page or email me below for more info about our mentorship program.
It's great to hear that there is such a program now.
Yeah, and it's run by your ex-PhD supervisor, Dr. Alan Premkumar.
He's amazing.
The last skill set a very important one that we would like to talk about, but also a very difficult one for many of us scientists, is networking. And I think you are very, it's very obvious that you are very good at that. You are very productive. You kept going to networking events, whether it's during your PhD or even when you are searching for a job, feeling lost because you don't have a job yet. For us, I think being in an academic environment, focusing on doing lab work all the times, it's so scary to step out to the environment where, you know, that there are no pipette for you. It's like I'm suddenly in the meeting room or in the dining place, and then a lot of people. It's quite scary. We think that anything could go wrong. We may get ignored, we may get rejected, we may get criticized, we may embarrass ourselves. What tips do you have for those who feel unsure about how to network effectively?
Yeah, I think it's probably it's an inner work that we need to do. First of all, I'd say, because the reality is everybody can feel incompetent or inconfident in certain areas. As scientists, we know we are good at what we do, but we are not good at other parts of, let's say, in the industry world, where we don't know much about the industry before you join the industry. To acknowledge that everyone is like us, and to remember that we also have a part, like we also have something that we are good at, and to give us like that self-assurance. But at the same time, as going back to being an introvert, like for me, it's quite natural and easy to go for networking. It gives me energy. I love seeing new people, hearing their stories. But if you are like me, you are very lucky. And I would encourage you to continue doing that. But if you are an introvert, then I would say find the comfortable way. And maybe sometimes you need to go out of your comfort zone. But initially, you can start with something that's not so confronting for you. As I mentioned, you could just message or email, because then it gives you more time to think what you would like to communicate. Or you could have, sometimes people are scared of group discussion. You could also arrange like one-on-one conversation, which is less intimidating. And also chat with other introverts and see how they network, and you probably can learn from each other. In fact, one of my introverted scientist friend, he was even thinking of building an app for introverts to communicate, because everybody is introverted. How can we make the communication better for all of us? I thought that was a pretty good idea.
That peer support is so meaningful.
Yes, you feel you are not alone. You are not the only one.
Thank you. I think a lot of tips that you shared with us will really help our listeners start thinking about how to design their own career transition plan. I think everybody's plan is just different. So I hope that what helped our listeners today is about how we can adapt your advice and make it personalized to whatever we want to do, no matter which career stage we are in. Before we wrap up, are there any final takeaways or pieces of advice that you would like to add?
Final piece of advice, actually, or not really advice, probably just my personal learning, is that work is not everything we have in life. So looking at my own journey, when I was back in China, you know, the competition was so high. I used to tell others, I said, I don't need rest. Or when I rest, it is for me to work better. So that was my mindset. Resting is for me to work better. And then I went to Singapore and still working very hard, doing my PhD. And now I'm in Australia, now I'm more than 30 years old. And I also just realized life, there is so much more in life than work. There's our family, our friends, our hobbies, and learning about other things in life. And at this stage, I think actually it's giving back. we all have a very privileged life, no matter whether you are in Singapore or in Australia, already very, very privileged. So it is important to give back with all the things we have got in our life. That's what I
Meaning.
wanted to share.
Thank you. We find meaning in work, but we can also find meaning outside work.
Yes, meaning is something we can create, like whatever you can create in that thing as meaningful, because you know, meaning could mean different things for different people as well.
Thank you so much, Eve. It's a very, very meaningful conversation for us. Thanks for
Thank
joining
you
us.
so much, Hatati. Absolutely my pleasure to be your first guest.
Azenta Life Sciences is excited to announce a rebranding initiative, bringing back the spirit of GeneWiz, energetic and fun. GeneWiz has supported the global scientific community for over 20 years through meaningful programs like GeneWiz Week and their grant programs, with the event taking place on the 8th to 12th September this year. Check out its LinkedIn page, GeneWiz from Azenta APAC, for the upcoming activities and programs. The NUS Yong Lu Lin School of Medicine celebrates 120 years of medical education this year. We thank GeneWiz for sponsoring this podcast. Don't forget to check out its website, genewiz.com, when you think of next-generation sequencing and gene synthesis. Follow GeneWiz from Azenta APAC on LinkedIn now. Please leave a comment with suggestions on content that you would like to listen to. Thanks for tuning in. Until the next episode.